Blog Talk Radio.
You may not be paid for the job.
Oh, and some of you will be
hello, everybody, and welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your hosts, Tim Burton and Kel Fritzy. We trust that you are having a wonderful day. We have quite a few articles to get through to share with you, as we are wont to do. But I would love to say hello to my co-host, and hello, Tim. How are you today?
Yes, good evening, Kel. I'm unbelievably well, and how are you?
As usual, I'm infidelity fine. I nearly wasn't, though.
Well, no.
My computer decided that it was going to crash all my pages 2 minutes before we go to air. So that was very lovely.
Oh, you're the consummate professional,
when
Kel. I have every confidence in you. When something like that happens, I know you're going to recover in time. And so it proved this evening. And just as a little aside, and absolutely nothing to do with anything, while I was just setting up the pages for the show, I happened to chance on, and don't ask me how I got to it, because I don't know. I found a page on the internet, questions asked by Muslims on Islam. And this is a very important question, is can my robot perform Hajj for me? If you have a domestic robot, this Muslim wants to know, can you send it to Saudi Arabia on a pilgrimage on your behalf? You know, if you're busy, if you've got stuff to do. No, seriously, it's a serious question, Kel. I imagine that lots of worthy clerics have been scratching their heads over this for weeks, trying to find out a suitable answer for this. And you can just imagine it, that robot that sells car insurance on TV. Well, I don't know if you have him over in Canada. Brian is his name over here. He might have a different name in Canada.
Yeah,
but he sort of trundles along on wheels selling people car insurance. And I can just imagine, you've got one of those robots and you'd like to go and do your Hajj, your pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia, but you just haven't got time. So you send your robot. And the only problem is that all your friends, they're all in the same position. They're all sending their robots as well. And all these robots running around.
Was that a serious question?
Hello, I am Brian. Can you save money on your car insurance? All these robots getting stuck in the sand and trundling up and down the sand dunes in Saudi Arabia. You can just imagine it. So anyway, the clerics on this page say, no, you can't. It's not allowed. If you have a domestic robot, ladies and gentlemen, and you want to send him on a pilgrimage on your behalf, be warned, it's not allowed. And there's a fatwa out against anybody who sends a domestic robot on a pilgrimage to Saudi Arabia. So just be warned. So there we go. That's my little contribution to this evening. And I'll pass the microphone back to you, Kel.
I don't know how you can. I'm still laughing. I love what Bigfoot just said in the chat room. A bunch of robots surrounding the Kaaba.
Well, I mean, you could make it, you could, I don't know, I mean, Disney would have a field day with this, wouldn't it? You know, what's that?
They would make a movie out of it.
Yeah, what was that robot, Wall-E? I forget what the name of the actual film was, but there's this, you could just imagine it, a whole bunch of
Wall-E. I don't know. They're so busy with the jihad, they're getting too lazy to go to Mecca. Oh, my goodness.
Well, apparently, somebody's obviously thinking ahead here, but thinking outside the box and thinking, well, I don't really feel like going to Hajj this year. I'd rather be on the beach and soaking up a few rays. I'll send my robot. Nobody will ever know.
So they really don't want to rock the Casbah.
Oh, quiet. It would just make a great film, wouldn't it? This guy sends his robot over to Saudi Arabia on a pilgrimage, and it gets into all sorts of terrible scrapes, And if anybody does make a film...
I can't believe this.
If anybody does make a film of that, remember, you heard it here first. I want some of the...
What we should do is that we should call, ask a Muslim and ask
Yeah, we should. We should ask a Muslim, shouldn't we? And see if he... Cause he
why don't we do that? Here.
We'll find him up. They probably haven't read this particular web page, and we could have some. We could have great fun, you know. We could say, you know, what's, what do you think? Can we send a robot or not? And we could see what he says. You know, he might have something constructive to say about the issue, because it's obviously a very pressing issue. The very fact that they've devoted a whole web page to this. Anyway, I digress, Kel. What have we got tonight? What have we got this evening?
I don't know yet.
Welcome to Ask a Muslim, the Islamic Information Line. If you want to ask, ask a Muslim. We are here to bring awareness to true Islam and eradicate every misconception. If you want to visit a local mosque, press 1. If you want to visit our website or want a free copy of the Quran, the Holy Book of Islam, press 2. If you have a question about Islam, press 3. If you want to listen to the Quran, press 4.
Sounds like we need to press 3, Kel.
I did.
Oh, okay.
Your call has been forwarded to the voicemail for...
Oh, voicemail.
Ask a Muslim.
No one is available to take your call. At the tone, please record your message. When you've finished recording, you may hang up or press the pound key for more options.
Hello, my name is Kel, and I'm wondering, is it okay if I send my robot to the to Mecca for the
This is a serious question, Kel. I think you should treat it with due deference. I really do. Excuse my colleague, Mr. Muslim, we have a serious question here, and it concerns domestic robots, which you know, I'm sure are becoming a very pressing issue in the Muslim world. What we want to know is, if we wish to send our domestic robot in our stead to go on pilgrimage on to the Hajj in Mecca in Saudi Arabia, is this permissible, Islamically speaking? It's a very important question, because one day all Muslims are going to have domestic robots, and they're all going to be asking you this question. So if you have a ready-made answer that we can disseminate for them, so much the better. No, he's definitely not picking up, Kel. He's definitely not picking
that
up.
That would be lovely. Oh, no, it's recording. They're getting our message. Yeah. The road to Mecca has become very, very... I can't believe this. The Tim, they have... entered the 21st century.
Yeah. I mean, there's all sorts of issues. You know, I mean, if your robot's halfway down the road to Mecca, you know, and it runs out of battery power, you know, I mean, there's a great cottage industry I can see springing up here with people supplying replacement batteries, you know, oil for squeaking joints, you know, spare wheels, all this kind of thing. You know, it could be a real money spinner for somebody. You know, I'm just wondering if they've thought it through, you know, because there could be a lot of money in there for somebody with the can-do attitude for repairing domestic robots on their way to Mecca. What do you think?
We're being asked in the chat room by Lucha, like, is this a real phone call? And yeah, it is. Yeah, this is what Tim and I do now. We phone Ask a Muslim. It's a real organization. And
yeah.
The phone number is 1-855-968-2756. And I think we're still recording on there. Answering service. But for some reason, they never take our call. They always refer us to via voicemail. It drives Tim and myself absolutely batshit crazy.
Yeah, it's a real shame, you know, because we could easily string this out to a, you know, 5 or 10 minute discussion with somebody on the other end of the phone. So, you know, I think it's highly inconsiderate because
you
have
exceeded maximum voicemail duration. Your message will be deleted unless you press 3 to save it. To listen to your message, press 1. To erase and re-record, press 2. To send, press 3. To send this message as urgent, press 4. Please enter your selection now.
What do you think? Urgent? I reckon that's got to be an urgent message, isn't it?
I think they're going to play our message.
You have exceeded maximum voicemail duration. Your message will be deleted unless you press 3 to save it. To listen to your message, press 1. To erase and re-record, press 2. To send, press 3. To send this message as urgent, press 4. Please enter your selection now.
They're clearly not interested in speaking with us, so we'll just hang up on them.
It's their loss, Kel. You know, it's a missed opportunity. You know, a little cottage industry on the road to Mecca. I could just see that, you know.
It's
a real mum and pop cottage industry, you know. Get your replacement batteries here for your domestic robot, you know, spare wheels, lubricating oil. You could make a fortune.
Oh, believe me, they have enough oil.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, there you go, you see, the raw material's already there in the ground, so, yeah, all you need's a bit of enterprise, there you go. So if anybody does want to set up such a cottage industry, remember, you heard it here first on Red Fox Radio Whale. right, back to, what was the original topic?
Where were we? I don't even know what show I'm on.
I do apologise, ladies and gentlemen. This is entirely my fault. If you've come in the last 5 or 10 minutes and you're wondering what the hell we're talking about, it's entirely my fault. I just happened to say I chanced upon a website, and I've no idea how I got here, but there was it was one of these websites where you ask a Muslim, and this particular question was being asked: am I allowed to take my domestic robot on pilgrimage to Hajj? In fact, can my domestic robot go in my place? And they thought it through, and they said, no, you're not allowed to do that with domestic robots, apparently. And I can only think it must be because there are these shortages of replacement batteries and spare wheels and so on, and people, you know, don't want the roads to Mecca cluttered up with, you know, dead robots sort of scattered all around the side of the road. I can only think that's the reason. That seems like an Islamically sound reason to me. So, yeah, that's probably it. I'm looking in the show notes tonight, Kel, and I see we actually do have a serious subject to talk about. You wouldn't know it, but we have. This is actually a serious radio show. And the subject tonight, in all seriousness, ladies and gentlemen, is to do with the news coming out of Nigeria and the abduction of almost 300 schoolgirls in Nigeria by Boko Haram. And I think you've got a few notes there, haven't you, Kel?
This has been distressing me. I have been badgering numerous people back and forth about this. One thing that's really upsetting me, though, Tim, is all of the sudden interest in the West about what's going on with the Boko Haram and the kidnapping of these Nigerian schoolgirls. Now, these are Christian schoolgirls. What appears, though, to have happened is that they kidnapped Muslim schoolgirls, and thus the outrage just exploded. So we have Hollywood, so-called Hollywood superstars, they are boycotting Beverly Hills Hotel because they are pushing Sharia law. We'll get into that one a little later. But it's interesting how all of a sudden the liberal elites are waking up. And in particular, though, is Michelle Hussein Obama with her little Twitter campaign saying, bring back our girls. It's like, oh, man, what is wrong with these people? It's taken this long to wake up. These guys have been active since 2002, and they have been kidnapping high school girls of high school age. They're 14, some odd. And all of a sudden, the Muslims, the Boko Haram, they start taking on kidnapping Muslim girls, and thus now we're hearing the outrage. I'm looking at this one article in particular, which is disturbing me. There is, I'm going to put the link in the chat room. I want everybody to click on this link and take a look at the photo accompanying this article. It really bothers me.
There we go, typing with one hand. But there is a bunch of ladies, they're standing around, and they have their placards, like I say. And there's one, though, Muslim and Christian women in solidarity. No. Please try not to gaslight us with this. Muslims and Christians do never stand in solidarity. But when Muslims are affected, it gets global attention. Why is that, Tim?
Well, I'm sure a lot of our listeners have noticed that this is not an uncommon scenario with anything that involves Christian persecution. The media is silent, the authorities are silent, and the overall effect is just to treat it as if it hadn't happened at all. But of course, where Muslims are involved, if there is a perceived wrong against Muslims, we've seen it before, and I'm sure we'll see it again, everybody is up in arms about it. And it says something about the success of Muslims to the ability of Muslims to portray themselves always as victims and never as the oppressors. But we know in this instance that what Boko Haram are doing is nothing more than following the edicts of Islam and Islamic principles. And the leader who has been on TV quite a lot recently, a chap called Abu Bakr Shekau, if that's how you pronounce his name, is quite open about it. He's quite clear that he's following Islamic principles when he does these things, which is something that the media and the authorities who perhaps ought to be apprising us of all this have manifestly failed to in their duty to highlight. And it's not as if Boko Haram have sprung out of nowhere. They've actually been going for, I think, since 2002. And so that's 12 years, during which time they've killed thousands of people. And the world has largely not taken a great deal of notice of it, because the people who have been killed have been predominantly Christians. And in line, as I said, with Christian persecution throughout Africa and throughout the Middle East, the world doesn't seem to have a great deal to say about it. So, I share your feelings on this, in that it's somewhat hypocritical that we're starting to get all these celebrities jumping on the bandwagon now, when it transpires that it wasn't just Christian girls that were involved. And you start to see things like Michelle Obama holding up a sign with a Twitter hashtag on it. Somebody should really tell her that the most effective way to use a hashtag is not actually by holding up a sign, but is typing the characters into a computer via a keyboard. But, you know, let's take these things one step at a time. Now, holding up a sign is a good start, and computer studies can always come later. You know, I'm sure as First Lady she can afford the tuition fees and so on. So we'll gloss over that one for the moment. But, yeah, it's symptomatic of the terrible hypocrisy that seems to be everywhere these days when it comes to the difference between Christian persecution and persecution of just about anybody else. The response is markedly different, and this is just one example of it.
What they're doing too is that they're talking about Goodluck Jonathan, and he is the he's a Christian, and he's the president of Nigeria, and they're saying that he's not doing enough to prevent this, and I don't think that that is the case. I think he's working diligently to try to preserve the Christianity in Nigeria. It is unfortunate, though, that people, politicians, like I am, well, as everybody knows, I am apolitical. I think that Goodluck Jonathan has actually been working very hard to stop this Boko Haram from infiltrating Nigeria, northern Nigeria in particular.
when the mainstream media reports on these particular people, though, they portray him as being nothing more than a talking head. No, he's been working hard. Well, he's been working hard since 2002 as a politician. Goodluck Jonathan has been working very hard as a politician since 2002 when the Boko Haram first came on the scene, which is very unfortunate that the Muslims are so capable of overrunning. Now, we see the Boko Haram in Nigeria. Tim, I worry. What are we going to see down the road in 20 years if these organizations continue to get their ways? Are we going to see what happened again in Russia when they took over that school? And I'm trying to remember the name of the school.
Beslan, in Tim? Beslan. Yeah.
Beslan, yes, thank you. And when... are we going to get to that point in Europe, in England, in Canada, the United States?
Well, the answer to that is we might well, because the conditions are very, very similar. And if there's one thing that I've noticed when I've been looking at how the pattern of Islamic expansion develops, the one thing I've noticed is that there are patterns. And one of the patterns that you get is that when there are more and more Muslims in a given population, then the problems become more and more dire. And as they become emboldened, they typically become much more cruel and commit much more violent outrages. It's one of the things about Islam, in that indoctrination with Islam, to the extent that a Muslim is indoctrinated, to that extent, they lose some of their humanity. And I think that's that may be seen by some people as oversimplification. But nevertheless, we do see that very devout Muslims have very little, or a lot of very devout Muslims, have very little empathy for the rest of the human race who happen not to be Muslim. This is entirely in keeping with Islamic tradition, because Islam divides the world into two, as we know. You have Darul Islam, lands that are ruled by Islam, and Darul Harb, lands that are not, and which are considered to be lands of war. And it is the duty of every devout Muslim to do everything they can, no matter how small those things might be, to further the cause of Islam and turn the lands of Darul Harb into Darul Islam. Now, given that Islam has a bloody tradition of fear, violence, intimidation and terror, we should not be surprised at the kind of things that go on in its name all around the world, as we see every day, reported in websites like thereligionofpeace.com. And what we're seeing with Boko Haram falls entirely in line with that. And it just so happens that they've done something. Boko Haram have done something which has tugged at our instincts, really, because as civilized people, we have a visceral gut response to anything happening to young children. By and large, this is true of most people in the West, I would venture to say. And if you have something that happens to very vulnerable young school children on this scale, most people in the West will be justifiably outraged. And this is something that's been reported in a way that arouses those very strong instincts in us. And, you know, we naturally want to do all we can to help. All right, Nigeria is a very, very large country. The resources there for actually undertaking any kind of rescue mission, it's much, much harder in that kind of terrain over that sort of large geographical area than it would be, say, if it was a couple of hundred children held hostage in a Western European city. But nevertheless, the urge is there to try and do what we can to help. But it is something that I think is not... not easily reconciled with the desire of people in high places only just taking an interest now. And people like Michelle Obama, where was she when Boko Haram was murdering 50, 60 school children only a few months ago? Did we hear a squeak then? Well, no. Where was she when hundreds of people were being murdered by Boko Haram in Nigeria over the previous years? You know, where she might have been expected to say something as First Lady about atrocities in that part of the world. Did we hear anything from her then? Well, no, we didn't. But now she's jumping on the bandwagon with the Bring Back Our Girls Twitter hashtag. And, okay, I have to say that the more publicity this cause gets, it can't do any harm. But I do think that it's hypocritical that everybody is jumping in now rather than when similar atrocities were occurring only a few months previously. And although this does involve the kidnapping of vulnerable young school children, there have been similar awful things that have been happening in that part of the world for quite some time. And it does stick in your throat a bit when celebrities decide to get onto the bandwagon right at this point.
I think that we're going to move into an article by a very fine lady with whom we're all familiar, and her name is Ayan Hirshi Ali. But Paul Alexander just posted a wonderful link in the chat room, and he is the proprietor of the blog Defender of the Faith, Guardian of Truth. And why is Washington against... my apologies, why Washington is deploying against Boko Haram. This is very interesting. I never knew this, Tim, but Nigeria is Africa's largest country, and it boasts the largest gross domestic product on the continent. It is also Africa's largest oil producer, ranking 8th in the world in terms of petroleum exports and accounting for 5% of U.S. foreign oil imports. Fascinating.
Well, of course, only a cynic would say that Washington's involvement with Nigeria is down to oil. I shouldn't laugh, really, because I'm sure there is something in that. You've got to remember that Nigeria is actually a country that hasn't been in existence all that long. There are over 500 dialects in the country, believe it or not, 170 odd million people, 500 languages. The common ones, there's Hausa, Fulani, and two or three others which I'm sure I could find if I need to. It didn't exist as just one country until about 100 years ago. And the south is largely Christian. The north is largely, well, it's largely Muslim now. I suppose it wasn't always Muslim, but the oil has made the south relatively prosperous. And I'm sure there's going to be somebody who's going to jump up and say, oh, well, it's just poverty that's causing it. All this trouble in the north is down to poverty. And if we throw money at it, the problem will go away, which is an argument that's commonly used elsewhere in the Middle East when trying to explain away Islamic atrocities. I would say that that is not the case. And all right, there may be considerations concerning the relative wealth of certain parts of the country, but that does not explain the prevalence of Islamic terrorism. Anywhere you look in the world, Islamic terrorism is not proportionate to the amount of wealth that's in a given location. All right, just so happens this location isn't particularly prosperous, but that is not the issue. Islamic terrorism is down to the fact that Islam demands that the infidel be terrorized. It actually calls for it in a number of places in the Quran, specifically, chapter 8, verse 12, chapter 8, verse 60, chapter 9, verse 29, chapter 9, verse 5. There's four off the top of my head, but the notion that this kind of problem is in any way related to wealth is quite wrong. It's quite well, I won't say risible because it's not a laughing matter, but it's certainly incorrect. But yeah, would oil have anything to do with the fact that Washington's getting involved at this stage? Well, I'm not sure, because we have had Islamic terrorism in Nigeria for a long time, and I suppose as long as the oil keeps flowing from the Christian South to America's benefit, there's no great need for intervention by Washington if they think, well, it ought to be sorted out internally by the countries in question. As long as it's not interfering with the oil production, you know, why would Washington get in at this point? So I'm not sure if that is guiding principle behind Washington's intervention now. I mean, Paul Alexander makes a good argument on his website, and if anybody's unfamiliar with his website at cpnagasaki.wordpress.com, I would urge you to go and visit it and to read it, because on the various articles that are written there, he makes a lot of sense. I'm not sure in this instance that I would say that oil or the lack of it is the overriding factor, because it's difficult to say where something like this happening in the north of the country might affect the ability of Nigeria as a whole to continue the production of oil. But you know, it is worth looking at it in the context of how important Nigeria is to Western interests. And I suppose somebody making policy in Washington might say that if the country were to fall into chaos as a result of Boko Haram destabilizing it, then that might have an adverse effect on American interests. So, well, maybe there is a little bit of the oil factor in there. But I don't know that it's the overriding factor right at the minute. I think a lot of people are genuinely outraged, and I think it's a shame that it's taken something like this in order to galvanize them to take action against what is admittedly a pretty horrific group that's been plaguing Nigeria for decades.
I think that what is going on is that you know, Tim, I have to agree with what you said, but we also have to keep into account about the valuable resources that Nigeria offers to the West. This is why I get very upset when Barack Hussein, Sotero, Obama refuses to allow the Keystone Pipeline, XL Pipeline, to be developed into the United States. Like, I know we're crude oil, but we can refine that oil. There are refineries in the United States that can refine our crude oil from Canada. We have enough oil to keep the United States going for decades and decades, and Obama is preventing that. So when Paul Alexander posts these articles, I kind of sit up and I read them. But there's a lot about Nigeria. It is resource rich. It's very resource rich. It's number four in terms of liquefied natural gas exports, for goodness sake. And so when organizations like the Boko Haram interfere with the commerce, of course the United States and the West in general is going to take note of this. But why is it taking so long? This has been going on since 2002. Where were the previous governments? I'm not laying this all on Obama. I despise the man, but I'm not laying it all on his shoulders. We've had previous administrations in the United States that have been aware of this. Why now, though? Why now? That's just my suspicious mind working again.
Well, yeah, I think it's a reasonable question to ask, and you can certainly make the case that there is a financial motive behind pretty much any action that a power like the United States might take. And no matter how altruistic actions might be, you know, if there is a financial benefit or a financial disadvantage that might be seen as a result of actions being taken or not taken, it's only natural that people should focus on that, and they should say, well, that is the reason. But I don't know that it necessarily is the reason right at the moment. I'd like to think that there is still enough good in human nature that when they see atrocities like this being undertaken by Boko Haram, obviously out of control and obviously needs to be I was going to say reined in, but exterminated might be a better word. I would like to think that people are genuinely and sufficiently outraged that if they're in a position to make a difference by organising an international relief or an international effort to either get these girls back or destroy Boko Haram or both, that altruistic effort shouldn't be just discounted because there is a financial gain or a financial consideration because the country happens to be rich. I don't think Nigeria is a particularly well organized country. I mean, the president,
like you say, it's a young country.
Yeah, the president, good luck Jonathan, he may well be well-intentioned, and he may well be doing everything that he can in order to keep a lid on things. But I don't think, as rich as the country is, that they've got anywhere enough in the way of security personnel I don't think they've really got the military capability to make the difference between keeping these groups at bay and seeming, you know, totally powerless in the face of the atrocities they undertake. I'd be argued that if he were a little bit more ruthless, then he might make more of a difference, but maybe he's not that kind of a guy. I'm reluctant really to make too many judgments about that particular president, because I don't have the detailed knowledge of him that I might say of somebody like David Cameron. Not that I'm saying David Cameron would make a better job of it if he was in the middle of Nigeria, although putting him in the middle of Nigeria might actually have other benefits, which I won't go into now, but at least he'd be out of our hair. But leaving that aside, you're looking at a country which is absolutely enormous, many, many times the size of the United Kingdom, three times the population of the United Kingdom, and with a largely ineffective security force, which has allowed the malevolence of Boko Haram to go pretty much unpunished. I know when Boko Haram started up, they did make some efforts to try and nip it in the bud, and I think if they had perhaps tried harder at that time, we would not be seeing what we're seeing now. But nevertheless, we are where we are, and if through this kind of atrocity occurring, it spurred people on to volunteer sufficient forces in order to make a difference and to eliminate Boko Haram and to bring the children back in the meantime, then so much the better. And I certainly think there's a good case to be made for utterly destroying Boko Haram as a threat to the country, because it hasn't confined its activities to Nigeria. You've got neighbouring countries of Niger, Chad and Cameroon, and they are being affected, if perhaps not quite in such great measure, but they're certainly being affected. We don't hear about it so much because Nigeria is the biggest country, and if there's trouble in that part of the world, then we'd hear about it more quickly than if we heard about similar trouble, I think, in Niger or Chad or Cameroon. But, you know, nevertheless, Islamic forces are expanding in that part of the world, and if they're allowed to do pretty much what they want, we're going to have a bigger problem further down the line than we have now. And then we'll see things like this, like these kind of atrocities. They will become even more commonplace than they are now. So there's certainly a good case for making that response. And I think ethically and morally, there is certainly an argument for doing whatever we can to help. With any kind of foreign intervention, of course, have to be a little bit careful, because you know what happened with Iraq and Afghanistan, where we went in to do what we thought was going to be a specific job, or that's how it was sold to us, and then 10 years later we're still in there losing good soldiers left, right and center. And if it's a purely military operation, where we put in sufficient resources to do the job, wipe out these vermin and then leave, that's one thing. But what tends to happen with any kind of foreign intervention is once politicians get involved, everything becomes much more murky, and an exit strategy is all of a sudden nowhere in sight, because there's people who are now arguing that, oh, well, we've put our soldiers in there on the ground, and the job's a bit more complex than we thought, so they're going to have to stay there longer. And before you know it, you're mired in yet another foreign war. Every day you're incurring casualties, and it's making you look bad for having gone in there in the first place. And politics tends to make even the purest of motives into a very grubby affair indeed.
What you said, malevolence. That's exactly what Islam is, and this is what the Boko Haram represents. This is, you know, it is tragic that this has been going on since 2002 with the Boko Haram, founded by Muhammad Yusuf. This is a tragedy within the Christian community. I have tried to wrap my head around this. Tim and myself, when we were deciding what topic we were going to discuss today, it's not because we all of a sudden jumped on a bandwagon. It's because we have been aware of this for so long. We have talked about this in the past. Tim and myself, we are not knee jumpers. We knew this was going on. I think where my I will not speak for you, Tim, but I think where my anger is coming from is that now Western politicians are all over the map with this. I think the biggest one that pissed me off was Michelle Hussein Obama, when she had her little hashtag going on there on Twitter. It's like, where the hell were you when Tim and I were discussing these issues years and years and years ago? I am so sick of this, Tim.
Well, and with good reason. And I think that if we had seen a more principled response from our political leaders, and you know, certainly even people like Michelle Obama, who's not, I suppose, she's not strictly speaking a political leader, but nevertheless, as First Lady of the United States, what she says and does is scrutinized, and it would have been nice if she had had something to say about it at an earlier stage.
No, she only stood up because the Muslims were getting kidnapped as well by the Boko Haram. That's when she came into the picture. That's it. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I am that bitter with this administration, and Obama had an opportunity to really speak out about it. I haven't heard a whole lot from him. Hollywood is speaking out about Sharia law because of the Dubai-owned, I believe it's Dubai. My apologies if I am mis.
Brunei, actually, Kel.
Brunei.
You're talking
thank
about
you.
The hotel in Beverly Hills.
Yeah,
is,
the
is
Beverly
the
Hills
one?
Hotel. Yeah.
Yeah.
And yes, it's Brunei owned, and they are cracking down heavily with the Sharia law, and the Hollywood elite is coming out, and they're speaking about it. And like, where were these people? when Iran fell, for example, Tim, in 1979, when people were being stoned to death for, you know, for being raped. Now they're all coming out, and what is this? Is this some sort of new craze amongst the leftists that, oh, we've got to do something about this? I'm sorry, Tim, but I'm just really mad.
Well, yes, with good reason. And, of course, the left has been silent on a lot of these things that you've touched on that have happened in the past. I mean, particularly with Iran, I mean, yes, you're right about 1979, but more recently in 2009, I believe, we had an attempt at a revolution in Iran that was brutally suppressed by the authorities there, and mm-hmm. it was a popular attempt to overthrow the repressive Iranian government, and Obama could have done a great deal more at that time to support the Iranian people in overthrowing a government which was not only oppressive in Islamic terms, but was also, and still is as far as we know, working towards acquiring sufficient nuclear technology to make bombs that are going to threaten countries in the Middle East, specifically Israel. But of course, once you've got a nuclear bomb, you can use it pretty much wherever you want. So the fact that we've got a country like Iran possession of technology like that should be a cause for everybody. And there was a heaven-sent opportunity only 4 years ago for Obama to support the Iranian revolution and to overthrow the the repressive Islamic regime that had been in place for some 30 years. And he manifestly failed to do it. But of course, that's consistent with his policy in pretty much every area, in that everywhere that he can support the cause of freedom, or he could support the cause of freedom, he manifestly fails to do so. And everywhere where it benefits Muslims to support them, that's what he does. And that is not really a good position for somebody who is supposedly the leader of the free world. But that has consistently been his position over the past 5 or 6 years.
You know what we should do? We're not going to completely switch gears, because believe me, people, we are staying with this. But I think I need to take a break, because I am getting myself worked up. We have a clip we want to play for you, and we have another article that we want to relate with you. But I think, Tim, that we should take the break. We're near the top of the hour. What do you think?
Okay. Yeah, sounds good to me. Kel, what have you got for us?
I'm going into Mike Holt's file.
Okay.
He has this really beautiful song by Chris Rea that he has not played on his show for over 2 months, so I'm going to play it on our show. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Devil in the Deep Blue Sea by Chris Rea. We'll see everybody back here in 4.5 minutes.
And the deep blue sea.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Red Fox Blogger with your hosts, Tim Burton and Cal Fritzy, and we are discussing Boko Haram and the kidnapping of the Christian schoolgirls, and boys have also been kidnapped. They're being murdered, and now they are kidnapping Muslim school children. But the Muslims apparently are being released back into the bosom of their families. But Tim and myself, we have a clip here that we want to share with you before we delve into an article. And this article is just absolutely fantastic. This is by Ayan Hershey Ali. But before we do that, please listen to this.
These girls, you occupy yourselves with their affair. We have indeed liberated them. We have indeed liberated them. Do you know we have liberated them? These girls have become Muslims. They are Muslims. It is now 4 years or 5 years that you arrested our brethren and they are still in your prison. You are doing many things to them. and now you're talking about these girls, we will never release them until after you release our brethren.
Tim, these are the Christian girls kidnapped who is reciting the Quran, and the Boko Haram is saying that they rescued them.
Well, that's pretty much par for the course, of course. They would hardly be likely to say, well, we did something terrible, you know, and we're really ashamed, so we'll perhaps stop doing it in future. That they're quite proud of the fact that everything that they're doing is Islamically sanctioned, and they're bound to present it in the most positive terms that they can, and they see it as a great deed that they have taken these girls and forced them to become Muslim, and they see it as a positive thing, even if the rest of the world has a different opinion. But this is par for the course. Wherever we see Muslims committing atrocities, they always claim they're doing it for the greater good. And it's just one reason why, in my view, Islam is incompatible with the advancement of humanity. Yeah. Now, that might seem like a sweeping statement, but I think when you take into account the amount of misery that is inflicted on the world due to Islam, I don't think it's an unreasonable statement. And I'm happy to challenge anybody who wishes to take me up on it. But there we go.
We have this wonderful article, and I stumbled upon it today. And Tim and I have been dissecting it before we came to air. And this is from the Wall Street Journal. This was written by Ian Hershey Alley. And I'm going to do a little bit of a verbatim reading because it is just so well written. And what Ms. Alley had to say was, since the kidnapping of 276 schoolgirls in Nigeria last month, the meaning of Boko Haram, the name used by the terrorist group that seized the girls, has become more widely known. The translation from the Hausa language is usually given in English language media as Western education is forbidden, though non-Muslim teaching is forbidden might be more accurate, and that is so true, Tim. But little attention has been paid to the group's formal Arabic name, Jamaat al-Sunnah lid-Dawah wal-Jihad, that roughly translates as the fellowship of the people of the tradition for preaching and holy war. That's a lot less catchy, though, than Boko Haram, but significantly more revealing about the group and its mission. Far from being an aberration amongst Islamic terror groups, as some observers suggest, Boko Haram, in its goals and methods, is in fact all too representative, and that is so true. Why is it that I'm going to pose a question, and I want people in the chat room to pay attention, and I want you to answer this. Why are we ignoring the fellowship of the people of the tradition for preaching and holy war? We are engaged in a holy war with the Boko Haram, Tim?
Yes, indeed. they make no bones about their goals and their aspirations, and it's the rest of the world that tries to make out that it's absolutely nothing to do with Islam, and this is something that we see pretty much everywhere. As I mentioned before the break, whenever Muslims commit atrocities in the name of Islam, there is always somebody who wants to stand up and say, well, they don't mean it, or it's nothing to do with Islam, or it's just an aberration, or it's just a tiny minority of people who are twisting the true traditions of Islam. I mean, we saw it on a somewhat different scale on the streets of Woolwich about 1 year ago, or almost 1 year ago today. Last May, drummer Lee Rigby was slaughtered on the streets of Woolwich by two Muslims acting in the name of Islam, who stood in front of a camera afterwards, and one of them quoted chapter and verse, chapter 9, verse 29 specifically, to justify what he'd done. and when he was finally sentenced, the judge ignored all this and said what you did was went against the true teachings of Islam, and that upset this particular jihadist more than somewhat, and he actually had a bit of a go at the judge in court. But the point is that people in authority who ought to know better are consistent in denying that these atrocities have anything to do with Islam, even though the people who are perpetrating these atrocities tell us over and over again that Islam is the reason behind what they're doing, and they can point to the Islamic scriptures, chapter and verse, and say, look, the Quran says we should do this, the Hadith, the Sunnah say that we should follow the example of the Islamic prophet Muhammad in what we do, and what Boko Haram is doing is absolutely Islamically correct, and we ought to take account of the fact that they are waging what they see as a holy war on us, and when they take young children, young female children, as sex slaves in this manner, they are only following the example of the prophet, who did exactly the same thing according to the Islamic text. Says, you know, there's no getting away from it that the Islamic prophet Muhammad took sex slaves, and he saw that as being part and parcel of what every good Muslim should do when they conduct holy war, which is what Boko Haram consider that they are doing. So yeah, we do see a certain amount of cognitive dissonance when people in authority tell us that it ain't so, because it is so. And you heard it here first. No, you didn't, ladies and gentlemen. I'm just saying that. It is the case that the holy war is what Boko Haram are undertaking. And no matter how many people, well-meaning people in authority, or people who are just plain ignorant or wish to appease Islam, no matter what they tell us, that is the case. Yeah. There is a war between Islam and the rest of humanity.
And this article, though, is so revealing, and I think Miss Ali did this justice, because she does expose what is going on with the Boko Haram, and she further explains the logic behind it, and that the kidnapping of schoolgirls, it throws into bold relief a central part of what the jihadists are about, the oppression of women. Boko Haram sincerely believes that girls are better off enslaved than educated. The terrorist's mission is no different from that of the Taliban assassin who shot and nearly killed 15-year-old Pakistani Nilayla Yousafzai as she rode a school bus home in 2012 because she advocated girls' education. As Ms. Ali says, as I know from experience, nothing is more anathema to the jihadists than equal and educated women. And you know what? This one, I own this one. This is mine, because I am so sick and tired of the subjugation of women within our societies. We're seeing enough bullshit, you know, in the West. And what's happening too is that we're being brainwashed in our university institutions today. But okay, I'm going to go off the map a little bit. I'm going to sidebar is what I'm doing, is that we are not being properly educated as to what is going on within the realm of Islam. We have bullshit professors in our Western institutions feeding us lies and feeding us facts that are contrary to the betterment of our own host countries within the West. But there are women out there who are literally dying to at least learn math and science, learn how to read, write, and speak their language proper. This is just craziness to me, Tim.
Well, yes, and it's all part of the leftist agenda to make us believe that Islam is a benign and tolerant religion of peace, fully compatible with our Western civilization and our cherished notions of parliamentary democracy. If they can make us believe that, I suppose the thinking goes, they'll make us believe anything. But unfortunately, they're well on their way, because of political correctness and multiculturalism, to making us swallow an awful lot of things which go completely against the grain in terms of common sense. 50 or 60 years ago, nobody on the left would have got away with this for one moment. We would have looked at it and we would have said, this is outright evil. What you're telling us is wrong. Islam is in no way compatible with Judeo-Christian traditions and values and our notions of Western civilization. And we do not want it here. And in fact, we should discourage it in every possible form. And we should also discount the other notions of leftist philosophy and dismiss them as just being totally totally ridiculous. 50 or 60 years ago, we wouldn't have had a problem with that. But we've had, since that time, we've had a revolution in our educational system, supported by our political elites in complicit with our mainstream media, and we've had that shoved down our throats, and it's made us not less intelligent, but less discriminating about the concepts that are being fed to us. If you've had 30 or 40 years of indoctrination with political correctness and multiculturalism, and you're taught that there is no such thing as absolute good and absolute evil, and that we shouldn't judge, all cultures are the same, and we shouldn't say that one culture is particularly superior to another. If you can swallow that, without critically analysing it, then all sorts of evils follow on the back of it, and that's what we're getting at the moment. We're being told that things like what we're seeing right in front of our eyes with Islam is not to be condemned. We are not to judge just because certain things happen in this way. Does not mean that Islam is necessarily a bad ideology. Well, excuse me, but yes, it does. Islam is a completely malevolent ideology, totally unsuited for the betterment of humanity over any given period of time, except perhaps for a few days in the 7th century. And we should not put up with it or tolerate it in our midst one moment longer. And that's what we should all be saying. People at the moment do not en masse stand up and say that, because we have had this 30, 40 years of indoctrination. And when you've had that sort of indoctrination on the scale that we have had it, it's difficult to fight against. It's not impossible. And people like us, Kel, you and I, and all the other fine people in the counter-jihad movement and all the fine listeners that we have here, they're well aware of what is at stake and what is involved. And each and every one of us has a duty to go out and inform our fellow man that, in fact, we have had the wool pulled over our eyes, that, in fact, the emperor has no clothes. And once we wake up a critical mass, things will change. And it might happen sooner than you think. But right now, we are being subject to this kind of ridiculous notions that are being put forward every day by people on the left who expect us to swallow it because they think that political correctness and multiculturalism, that sort of indoctrination, cannot be reversed. Well, I have news for them. It can be reversed. And what's more, we are going to reverse it. But right now, that's what we're seeing every day. And it shouldn't surprise those of us who are paying attention that the left are getting more and more frantic because they're starting to realise that their lies are not being swallowed quite so readily as they were perhaps even this time last year.
What I don't understand is why the West is so baffled by this. You know, these days we know so much more about the scourge. And ladies and gentlemen, the scourge, capital T, capital S. We know so much about the scourge of Islam, and why is it that when we speak out about it, we're called Islamophobes? When we try to stand up for women's rights, and you heard me a few minutes ago talking about basic education, learning their language, learning math, basic math, for goodness sake. Why is it that we don't get accolades for speaking up about very basic rights? Where are the Muslim college student organizations denouncing Boko Haram? Where is the outrage during Friday prayers? These girls' lives deserve more than a Twitter hashtag protest. And organizations like Boko Haram do not arise in isolation. The men who established Islamist groups, whether in Africa, like Nigeria, Somalia, Mali, Southwest Asia, like Afghanistan, Pakistan, or even Europe, the UK, Spain, and the Netherlands, are members of long-established Muslim communities, most of those members who are happy to lead peaceful lives. To understand why the jihadists are flourishing, you need to understand the dynamics within these communities. And I just quoted verbatim from Ms. Ali's article. But imagine this. Imagine an angry young man in any Muslim community anywhere in the world. Imagine him trying to establish an association of men dedicated to the practice of sunnah, and that is the tradition of guidance from the Prophet Muhammad. Much of the young men's preaching will address the place of women. He will recommend that girls and women are to be kept indoors and covered from head to toe if they are to venture outside. He will also condemn the permissiveness of Western society. What kind of response will he meet? Well, in the U.S. and in Europe, some moderate Muslims might quietly draw him to the attention of authorities. Women might voice concerns about the attacks on their freedom. But in other parts of the world where law and order are lacking, such young men and their extremist messages thrive. And this is where our governments are weak, ladies and gentlemen. This is where they are corrupt or non-existent. The message of Boko Haram and its counterparts is especially compelling. Not implausibly, they can blame poverty on official corruption and offer as an antidote the pure principle of the Prophet. And in these countries, women are more vulnerable and their options are fewer. And I'm going to stop verbatim there, Tim. And I am going to offer up this, that we are seeing this globally. We are seeing this in the West. These Muslims, these organizations, they are infiltrating everywhere, and we're not paying attention. It is like there is no recourse. Our governments are very weak. Tim?
Well, they certainly are weak, and they're weak for a number of reasons, which we've discussed on various radio shows together. One is they are afraid of what might happen if they stand up. They're afraid that they might incur the wrath of Muslim communities in the country they happen to be in. That is a valid concern, in as much as if Muslims perceive that Islam is being in any way threatened or cannot expand in the way that Muslims want it to expand, then they are likely to get very vocal about it. And you do need politicians with a certain amount of backbone to be able to resist that. And unfortunately, backbone is something we don't have in our current crop of politicians. They prefer to pretend that either the problem isn't happening, or if it is happening, it's all the fault of us greasy Islamophobes. And consequently, because they are basing their policies on fantasy rather than reality, the situation is only going to get worse. Fear is one thing. Appeasement is a related factor. Greed is another factor. They don't want to see Muslim communities around the world coming out in sympathy and perhaps having an economic backlash on our country. If politicians stand up, that might conceivably happen. The only problem, of course, is that the longer that politicians put off this kind of action, the worse it's going to get. It's never going to get any better on its own. Islam has a goal, which is to convert, subjugate, or kill the rest of us. And if they have to do it through fear, violence, intimidation, and terror, rather than peaceful dawah or proselytizing, then that's what they'll do. There is absolutely they have absolutely no scruples about doing that. They don't fear the law of the kuffar. As far as they're concerned, it's Islamically justified, and if something's Islamically justified, they will do it and carry on doing it until we stop them. And if we do not stop them, then we will be, in time, we will be overrun. And our civilization, with all the good that it has for potential, the potential good it has, in my view, for the advancement of humanity, that will be a thing of the past. And I think that that would be a terrible thing to allow. And just because our current political elites seem intent on allowing it, doesn't mean that the rest of us have to. And we are getting very close to the point where we are going to have to take steps which are perhaps outside the democratic way of doing things in order to make our politicians see sense. Now, I'm not condoning violence, ladies and gentlemen. I do not want to see blood on the streets. And I believe the problems that we see in our Western democracies anyway can be resolved without recourse to that kind of action. But if our nevertheless if our politicians refuse to take any action, we are most certainly headed down a path to civil war, and I think that's a terrible thing. It's a criminal thing to allow that. If you're in charge of a country and you can take a course of action which stops civil war breaking out, I think that you are duty bound to take that course of action. Now, call me old Mr. Naive if you will, but you know, we pay these people to take decisions that protect us from foreign and domestic enemies, and we pay taxes. When I say we pay these people, we do it through taxes, and it forms part of a contract, and they are not living up to their side of the bargain. So that's one thing. But yeah, in some parts of the world where you don't have the democratic systems that we have here, where you don't have law and order as we understand it in civilized Western countries, then yes, there is an argument which says that, well, that's not an argument. It is the case that people who preach that what Boko Haram is doing is not only Islamically correct but morally and ethically justified, that will find fertile ground in those sort of countries. We're extremely lucky in some ways to have the rule of law and order and the democracies that we do in our Western countries, but they're not made of cast iron, and they are susceptible to civil unrest on a large scale. And civil unrest on a large scale is what Islam does very well. So we ought to be stepping in and doing something about it sooner rather than later, because, as I said when I started speaking, these problems are not going to get better on their own. We have to tackle them. So when we see something like Boko Haram in Nigeria, I think an international effort to do something about it and to stamp it out is actually something that you could argue for on a moral and ethical level, quite apart from financial considerations and whether the supply of oil keeps flowing to the West. I think if we see our Christian brothers being slaughtered and treated in this fashion, I think there's... I'm not framing this purely in religious terms, I have to say. I'm framing it in moral and ethical terms that everybody should be familiar with if they subscribe to the Judeo-Christian notion of civilization. And I think on those moral and ethical principles, we do have a duty to go in and confront evil. The only difficulty being, of course, that if it's not thought about very, very carefully about exactly how we're going to do it, we might find ourselves mired in yet another foreign war from which it's difficult to extricate. But, you know, I think there is a good case to be made for going in and doing something about it.
Oh, absolutely. And believe me, when when I read, for example, I'm just going to refer back to the article. And Tim, what you have been saying is bang on as usual. That's why we pay you the big bucks to be on Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, I can hardly. I have to take. I've got a huge wheelbarrow here. It's full of dollar bills. I have to wheel it out of the house every day after one of these shows. I don't know how you can afford to pay me so much, Kel. It's you know, it's embarrassing, really. But leaving
hey,
that aside,
put a second mortgage on the house, okay?
But leaving
you're
that
worth
aside,
the, you're worth sending the paycheck.
Okay, leaving that aside, you do make a serious point, yes.
It is interesting, though, that the one thing I'm confused about in this article is that Miss Ali refers to the young zealots being imaginary, and that and why do they turn to violence? I think, you know, she may be leading up to a point. And let me see if I can wade myself through this. But why does our imaginary young zealot turn to violence? At first, he can count on some admiration from his fundamentalist message within the community where he starts out. He might encounter opposition from established Muslim leaders who feel threatened by him, but he perseveres because perseverance in the sunnah is one of the most important keys to heaven. As he plods on from door to door, he gradually acquires a following. There comes a point when his following is as large as that of the Muslim community's established leaders. That's when the showdown happens, and the argument for holy war, quote-unquote, suddenly makes sense to him. Now, the history of Boko Haram has followed precisely this script. The group was founded in 2002 by a young Islamist called Mohammed Yusuf. And ladies and gentlemen, please scroll up into the show notes. The links are all right there. You can click on them, and it will take you right to these sites. He started out as preaching in a Muslim community in the Borno state of northern Nigeria. He set up an educational complex, including a mosque and an Islamic school. For 7 years, mostly poor families flocked to hear his message. But in 2009, the Nigerian government investigated Boko Haram and ultimately arrested several members, including Yusuf himself. The crackdown sparked violence that left about 700 dead. Yusuf soon died in prison. The government said he was killed while trying to escape, but the seeds had been planted. Under one of Yusuf's lieutenants. Oh, gosh, here come those fake names again. Abu Bakr Shekau, Boko Haram turned to jihad. Now, in 2011, Boko Haram launched its first terror attack in Borneo. 4 people were killed. And from then on, violence became an integral part, if not the central part, of its mission. The recent kidnappings, 11 more girls were abducted by Boko Haram on Sunday, and they join a litany of outrages, including multiple car bombings and the murder of 59 schoolboys in February in 2011. On Monday, as if to demonstrate its growing power, Boko Haram launched a 12-hour attack in the city of Gambaro, Negla, firing into market crowds, setting houses aflame, and shooting down residents who ran from the burning buildings, and hundreds were killed. Okay, my question to you, ladies and gentlemen, is why has this gone below our radar? This group is ruthless. This group is murderous. Look what it is capable of doing, for God's sake. Leaving 700 people dead in 2009, in 2011, the kidnappings of girls and the murder of 59 schoolboys. Like, this is just unfathomable to me. And I'm sorry, Tim, but it's breaking me up.
Well, it is a pretty horrific story, and it just shows what can happen when people are driven by the Islamic imperative. Far from being a peaceful ideology, Islam finds it very effective to get its own way by slaughtering anybody and everybody who is seen to be opposed to them. And it's all part and parcel of the Islamic ideology, as I was going over earlier, with the division in Islamic ideology of us and them. Anybody who is not a Muslim is to be treated completely differently, and not in a good way, to people who are Muslims. So when they do these things in order to flex their muscles and show their power, they do it in the knowledge that the majority of people that they are killing are Christians, and therefore don't have the same rights in any Islamic meaning that we would consider in the civilized society. So why has it gone under our radar for so long? Well, excuse me. There's a lot of atrocities that go on around the world every day in the name of Islam, murders and similar outrages committed by Muslims every day. To a certain extent, when you consider there's been nearly 23,000 fatal attacks since 9/11 throughout the world by Muslims in the name of Islam, on one level you might think, well, people become slightly desensitized to it. They think, oh, it's just another Islamic atrocity, nothing to see here, let's just carry on. Excuse me. But
I know, exactly, and that's what I'm thinking too, is that... you know, I am imploring with the audience that I did not realize just how much that relating this story would bother me, but it is. And I want to thank Tim very much because he's really coming to bat for me. Tim is carrying the show. And if it weren't for him, I don't think I could get through this particular topic matter. It's really bothering me. And we played that clip for you 30 minutes ago about how they were converting these Christian schoolgirls. They were rescuing them. Oh, my goodness. They were what they were doing, and ladies and gentlemen, we know this as reversion, and that's what they do. That's what Islam thinks. Islam thinks that we are all born Muslims, and we don't convert. We revert back. And this is what they're striving to do. This is the mentality that we're dealing with, in that when they come out and they kidnap these girls, they honestly think they're rescuing them. They don't understand the difference between morality, right and wrong. It is the Boko Haram. But what they're also doing, they're turning them into sex slaves, and they're slitting the throats of the girls who refuse to revert. They're killing them. They're murdering them. This is what's going on in Nigeria. This is what Tim and I are relating with you today. And relating these stories, this one in particular, I don't know why, Tim, but this one really got to me, and it really threw me off my game. But, you know, I'm so sick and tired as well of hearing that Muslims, the average Muslim, rejects the use of violence and terror, and they do not share the radicals' beliefs that a degenerate and a corrupt Western culture needs to be replaced with an Islamic one. And Muslims, you know, the average Muslim, they abhor the denigration of women's most basic rights, hello, and education. Well, you know what? And believe me, if you listen to Radio Jihad Network, if you listen to the East, oh God, Jeff is going to fire me, EDL Radio, you listen to what these people are telling you. You know what? Because they're not standing up. They are so-called peace-loving Muslims. They have to do a hell of a lot more, much more. They have to resist those in their midst who engage in this type of prophesizing before they proceed to the phase of holy war, because this is what we're facing. They are proceeding into the phase of holy war. I am not an alarmist. I'm a realist. I know that this is what jihad is. This is kinetic jihad. This is legal jihad. Hello, Tim. This is governmental jihad. This is jihad taking place right underneath our noses in our colleges and universities. We have the power to stop it right now. But we have to deal with weak politicians. We have to deal with governments that will not listen to us. We have to put up with people, the dimmies out there, for example, that when we talk about these issues, these true issues, these very, very serious issues, which is a threat to the Western countries, our Western way of life, we have to put up with the dimmies who call us Islamophobes. We have to deal with the politicians that say, no, Islam is okay, and we're going to grant them their bloody organizations, and we'll even fund them with your tax dollars. This is what we're putting up with. But you know what? The writing is on the wall. For goodness sake, how many more of these stories do you need to hear to understand exactly what is going on within the realm of jihad, within the realm of Islam? There is no such thing as a moderate Muslim. No such thing. Because you know what? They're Mohammedans. They follow the Quran. And if you are a Christian, you follow the teachings of Christ. If you are a Buddhist, you follow the teachings of Buddhism. You're a Muslim, you're following the teachings of Muhammad. And this guy was clinically insane when he dreamed up this bloody so-called religion. And look at the havoc it has wreaked upon the planet. And now we have over 200 schoolgirls either being slaughtered or gang raped 12 times a day or agreeing to convert to Islam. And this is what we want to see in the West. Do you want to see this in Europe? Do you want to see this in Canada, the United States? Is this what you're prepared to deal with? I implore you, people, do not deal with this. This is insanity. And believe me, I am sucking on the helium balloon again, but I did not realize just how much this story would touch me. These are human beings. These are little girls and little boys. And they have families, and there are moms and dads who are sitting there, and they're crying, and they're wondering, are they going to see their child again? This is Boko Haram. This is what's happening in Nigeria. We have to wake up the populace, and we have to apprise people. We have to apprise the politicians that a bloody hashtag on Twitter is not bloody enough. Hi, Tim.
Well, no, you make some very good points then. I think what I would summarize everything that you're saying is we should look on this as a teaching moment. All those people out there who think that Islam is a benign and tolerant religion of peace and has nothing but good to offer humanity and is totally compatible with Western civilization needs to explore this story as deeply and as thoroughly as they possibly can. There's no shortage of people out there now who are writing about Boko Haram and what they're doing in terms which are, you know, quite easy to understand. I mean, over the last 10 years, Boko Haram might have been presented as a fringe group who was perhaps up to no good in some far-flung quarter of the world, and it didn't really matter to us very much. As Neville Chamberlain once famously said in the 1930s when he was talking about trouble in Czechoslovakia, when Hitler's armies were building up in preparation for World War II, his view was that Czechoslovakia was a faraway country of which we know very little. And the end result was, well, not the end result, there were obviously a lot of other factors, but very shortly after he said that, and shortly after the notorious appeasement of Hitler by means of a treaty, a piece of paper which meant peace in our time, we were effectively pushed into the Second World War. But the reason I'm bringing that up is that this is a teaching moment in what can happen when Islam is allowed to expand unchecked and unrestrained, and it's unmitigated evil. And it has been unmitigated evil over the past 1400 years wherever Islam has expanded. And now we're seeing it unfold in front of us, Islam red in tooth and claw, as it were. And we're being presented with a message that is very, very different from what people on the left of the political spectrum have been feeding us for the last 30 or 40 years. They say Islam is a benign and tolerant religion of peace. And yet, when we read about what Boko Haram are doing in the name of Islam, and they're absolutely Islamically correct in what they're doing, a different picture is emerging. And we should be treating this as a teachable moment, a moment where we can say to people, we're not Islamophobic or racist when we stand up and we point these things out to you. What we're explaining to you is that Islam, despite its very fluffy bunny image that is being promoted by Muslims and by people on the left, is actually a wolf in sheep's clothing. And it's a wolf in sheep's clothing to the extent that it stands a very good chance of destroying whatever attempts at civilization might be tried in the north of Nigeria, and that's today. Tomorrow it'll probably spread to the surrounding countries. In 10 years' time it'll probably have spread across the whole of the sub-Saharan continent with central... we've already had an awful lot of trouble in Central African Republic this year, as I'm sure our listeners will remember. There's a Muslim violence, exactly the same Islamic imperative in the Central African Republic, which is not too far away from Nigeria. And it just so happens that in that country, Christians decided to organize themselves and fight back, at which point, of course, the leftist political machine got into action and started campaigning for help for all those poor Muslims in the Central African Republic who were being unjustly slaughtered by those nasty Christians. And I don't doubt that when we see any kind of fight back against Boko Haram, it's going to be presented in precisely those terms by the political left. Look at these poor people being persecuted by these nasty non-Muslims. You know, we've got to help these poor Muslims. But of course, it's going to be much more difficult for them to do now in Nigeria because the world is watching. The world can actually see what is happening now. And the world is a lot better informed than it has been at any time in the recent past because of the internet. People like you and me and our listeners can pull up articles on Nigeria and on Boko Haram by the dozen, and we can look at them, we can analyze them, and we can come to a conclusion very quickly that this is nothing to do with Muslims being oppressed. This is everything to do with Muslims following Islamic ideology to its obvious conclusion and killing and enslaving non-Muslims on a scale which threatens to completely destabilize the country. We can see this. So it's going to be much harder for the left to push the narrative that they have been quite successfully pushing to us because we haven't been paying attention. Well, now we are paying attention, and I think we need really to bring the true nature of Islam to everybody's attention, and this is a good teaching moment to do it with. I'm very sorry that it's come at the expense of the agony that the parents of these girls must be feeling, and not just their parents but all their relatives must be feeling at this time. It must be one of the worst things in the world to have your child forcibly taken like this and not knowing if you're ever going to see them alive again, quite apart from the prospects of what happens to them when they're in captivity. So I am mindful of that, but I still think that the best thing that we can do, the best service that we can do here now on this radio show and with everybody that's listening, is to get the word out there and explain that this is what Islam is like. Because now you're going to find, when you go to work or when you're chatting to your friends, or when you just meet somebody in a shop and start up a conversation, they'll have heard of Boko Haram. They may not know exactly what's happening to the extent that we know, but they will know that something bad is happening, and this is our chance to explain to people the Islamic imperative behind all this, and to make them see that being critical of Islam is not a bad thing. If you're anti-Islam, that is not a bad thing, no matter how much the left might tell you that it is. If you criticize Islam, oh, you're an Islamophobe. Oh, you're a racist. Yeah. Well, no. Islam has a lot of bad things about it, and it should justifiably be criticized at every opportunity. And people who do criticize it are not Islamophobes, they're not racists, they are people, concerned citizens with common sense, who do not want to see all the advances that have been made in humanity destroyed overnight or set back by 1,000 years. We don't want to see that. And what Boko Haram are doing is providing us with a very clear picture of what will happen if Islam is allowed to expand unchecked and unrestrained, and we should all learn from that.
I want to close out this article by Miss Ali, and this is her final paragraph, but believe me, it's her warning as well. I'm going to recite this verbatim because I think this is important for people to listen and pay attention to. It is also time for Western liberals to wake up. If they choose to regard Boko Haram as an aberration, they will do so at their own peril. The kidnapping of these schoolgirls is not an isolated tragedy. Their fate reflects a new wave of jihadism that extends far beyond Nigeria and poses a mortal threat to the rights of women and girls. If my pointing this out offends some people more than the odious acts of Boko Haram, then so be it. And those are the words of Miss Ali, who is a fellow of the Belfer Center at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She is also the founder of the AHA Foundation. Ladies and gentlemen, heed the words of these people that are telling you what is going on. You listen to the Radio Jihad Network, for example. As a matter of fact, Vito Esposito is gracing our chat room, and he has his program on tonight at 6 p.m. That will be in an hour and 10 minutes. Heed the words of Luchadora, who is also part of the Radio Jihad Network. Her and Eliza Jane, 6 p.m. That's Eastern Time. And listen to Tim and myself over there at the Radio Jihad Network. We're on tomorrow night at 6 p.m. There are so many programs out there. Listen to Jeff Mitchell of the English Defense League radio show. Listen to what everybody's telling you, because we are not Islamophobes. We're Islamo-realists. Right, Tim?
Yes, indeed. And that's something I would counsel everybody to say if you're ever accused, heaven forbid, but if you're ever accused of being an Islamophobe, just explain patiently that there's no such thing as Islamophobia, because a phobia is a fear of something that's non-existent or something that should not be a cause for concern. Well, Islam is a cause for concern, and anybody who thinks that that is the case is an Islamo-realist, not an Islamophobe. Nikolai Sennels, who is a Danish psychologist, actually coined another term recently. He said, people aren't so much Islamophobic, they're more Islamo-nauseous. And he says we ought to be terming the phrase Islamo-nausea, because we're just sick of Islam and everything that Muslims are doing in its name. And that's not a bad term either. So feel free to use that. That's from Nikolai Sennels, who's a Danish psychologist. Mm-hmm. But Islamo-realism does really sum it up much more succinctly than Islamophobia. So don't accept, if anybody ever uses that term, don't let it pass. Don't accept it. Don't allow them to stick that label on you. Just explain very calmly that there is no such thing. And anybody who uses that word, they use it because they have not thought it through. They've been presented with the word and been told that it's a valid word to use when they encounter somebody who is critical of Islam. But don't accept it, ladies and gentlemen. You don't have to be rude to people. I mean, I like being rude to people, but you don't have to. You can be polite to people.
You are so rude.
you can just say, I'm not accepting that label that you stick on me. And the same's true of racism, of course, when people say, well, you're a racist. You can't criticize Islam. I stood up in court only a month ago and said exactly the same thing when I was accused of being a racist because of something critical I had said about a Muslim and to do with Islam. And I had to explain to the prosecuting counsel that Islam is not a race and Muslims are not a racial group. And he was just as brainwashed as everybody else that I've met who puts forward these things. He actually posed the question to me 6 times over a 30-minute period, and I had to respond in the same way each time. But don't let people grind you down with labels. You have right on your side. You have truth on your side. And just because somebody shouts racist at you, that says more about them than it does about you. So don't let them stick that label on you. Racist or Islamophobe. Don't let it happen.
And we won't. And believe me, Tim Burton is an example of that, in that he's not going to be beaten down, and he's not going to let Islamists walk all over him, nor am I, nor is anybody in this chat room. And you know what? We have quite a busy chat room, and Tim and myself, we are so grateful that you're taking time out of your busy day to spend with ours, and that includes Agador, Bigfoot, Path, Dartstar Internet Radio, Dodgy Dave, Jeff of the English Defense League. We have some guests in here. Lucha Dora, Moving Forward, Paul Alexander, T.P. Nani, and Vito Esposito, and Sue from New Mexico, my sweet Sue from New Mexico, listening in the studio. And Agador, Bigfoot, Cap, Dart, Dodgy Dave, Jeff, Lucha Dora, Moving Forward, Paul Alexander, T.P. Nani, and Vito Esposito and Sweet Sue from New Mexico. So there you go, Tim.
Yeah, I do appreciate, as Kel does, all you good people turning up to listen to us every week. And this has been an especially distressing issue in some respects. We're having to discuss what has happened to these poor girls in Nigeria. I know Kel has been particularly affected by it, and every right-thinking person ought to be concerned that such things go on in the world. Well, okay, the world is an evil place, but that doesn't mean that we have to sit back and allow it. When we see evil occurring, it behoves each of us to do what we can in whatever way we can in order to do our little bit to try and make the world a little bit better. And if through some of the things we've said tonight and some of the things that other concerned patriots have said in various places on the internet and on various blogs and various radio shows and social media, if some of that spurs our political leaders to take some positive action to deal with the evils of Islam, whether it be in Nigeria or in other parts of the world, then we've made a difference. I'm not saying that Islam is going to disappear overnight, much as I might personally like it to, but we have to start somewhere. And if this is the catalyst for something to take place which is going to make a difference, then that's something that you can justifiably be proud of. and I'm talking to all of you here because you all have the knowledge and the capability to go and talk to people that you know, whether it's at work or it may be in your family or your friends. And if you only convince one person every now and again, then that one person might go on and convince 10 others. So we can make a difference, all of us, by doing just that, just explaining what we see in terms that people can understand. And Boko Haram is something that everybody can understand. There's nothing that you could point to and say there's nothing that you could point to within Boko Haram and say, yes, but they were operating from pure motives, because they're not. I mean, you can tell by the fact they're very happy to take these girls, turn them into sex slaves, sell them in the market. It's evil. It's unmitigated evil. And that's what Islam does to people. But I'll pass the microphone back to Kel, because I know we're winding the show up now, Kel, and I'll let you wrap it all up for us.
Tim, thank you very much. You pretty much carried the show tonight, because I did not realize just how emotional I would get with this, and it bothers me greatly that Islam is carrying on out there, and they're killing very lives, and what the Boko Haram is capable of in Nigeria, what they did, I cannot fathom this. I cannot wrap it around my head. I pray for the families of the victims of Boko Haram. I pray for the moms and the dads that stand on their porches and they weep and they cry and they wonder, am I going to see my son or my daughter again? This is a human tragedy. And you know, I'm lucky that I have such a great co-host that can help me out with this, because believe me, I don't think this is a story I could ever have done on my own. So, Tim, I am eternally grateful to you, and I'm grateful to the listeners in the chat room that have been encouraging me. People know that I get very emotional and wrapped up about the topics that I cover, but I have great friends, I have a wonderful family, and I have all of you, and you are here, and you make me move forward. You bolster me, and so I want to thank you personally from Cal. But Tim, hey, we're going to see you tomorrow night at Radio Jihad Network.
Yeah, certainly are, Kel. I wouldn't miss it for the world. And thank you very much for those kind words. But really, you know, we made this happen together, and you're just as much a part of it as I am, if not more so. I mean, they don't call it Red Fox Radio Whale for nothing. It's got a red fox in there.
There you go.
So thank you very much for joining us, ladies and gentlemen, and I hope you'll come back again and join us next week.
Absolutely. And good night, everybody.
Yes, good night, Kel. Good night, everybody.
Keep hope alive.
I know sometimes in life you feel that everything is lost, and that mountain is just too high to climb.
Keep hope alive.
Well, that's when you gotta dig deep down inside and reach that inner strength you never knew you had. Give you the will to carry on another day. And all the day goes by and you're outside, still wondering why, watching everything you work so hard, and life all begins to fall apart. It breaks your heart to see it all crumbling at the wayside. You wanna lay your head down, pack it in, and say goodbye, cause there's nothing left here to keep hope alive, until you see the only two things in life that really matter. It's a little girl and a little boy, one's your foolish pride, one's your beautiful joy, and what's left of a candy bar when it's like the remains of a Chips Ahoy. Playing with a piece of driftwood, they create a little mind made into a beautiful toy. And at that moment you realize you gotta rebuild everything Mother Nature had just destroyed. Their precious little heartbeats, if you respect over a thousand men, gave you the will to get back up on your feet again. Because you knew right then this battle wasn't about you, it's all about them. And you reassured them like only a daddy can. And they knew right then that everything was gonna fall apart.
Hold on.
us from harm's way, putting in all those hours, and all my friends working day and night, making it right here, tunnel of towers, bringing us hope like a ray of sunshine, peeking through the clouds, clearing the showers. Well, here's to you, two shots of whiskey, one Jameson, one Johnny Powers, from Coney Island to Seaside Heights, Long Beach, we bought the Lower East Side, mass of people, the sheep said,